Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another installation of Boys Town with Aaron, a Timeline Earth production. Today I have with me Michael, the Barbary Corsair, the owner and proprietor of the Stateless Cook podcast, and we're going to talk a little bit about globalism.
Indeed we are. Although I do want to make one quick correction. It's not a podcast so much as it is just a website.
It's a podcast. You're a libertarian. You have a podcast.
Okay,
that's
fine.
Just how it goes.
We'll call it that at least for now.
So how have you been, man?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Yeah. As I've mentioned many a time on the timeline here recently, I have moved out to the country recently. And holy shit, is it so much nicer out here.
Yeah. Yep. If you can manage to do that and still maintain your level of comfort, I fucking would in a heartbeat. If my girlfriend wasn't such a blue-pilled cosmopolitan, I would do that in a heartbeat. No, yeah. She's not Jewish. I don't mean it that way.
Well, maybe a little bit around the edges.
Yeah. No, she is firmly white trash Irish Catholic.
Oh. Yeah.
My kind of lady.
Yeah. Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
But
yeah.
Anyways, I'm gonna start this off with a quote from somebody that I know for a fact is a great influence in libertarianism, just a stand-up guy. The quote goes, "We must bear in mind that imperialism is a world system, the last stage of capitalism, and it must be defeated in a world confrontation. The strategic end of this struggle should be the destruction of imperialism. Our share, the responsibility of the exploited and underdeveloped of the world, is to eliminate the foundations of oppressed nations from where they extract capital, raw materials, technicians, and cheap labor, and to which they export new capital, instruments of domination, arms, and all kinds of articles, thus submerging us in absolute dependence." And that is our guy, Ernesto Che Guevara. What do you think about that?
I mean, man, that's a complicated one, because on the one hand, yes, I agree with some of this. The first section of the first sentence, at any rate, because I don't necessarily agree that it's the last stage or any stage of capitalism, but I work with a different definition of capitalism than Mr. Guevara does. So, by his definition, from my understanding, it would be an accurate statement. From mine, less so. But we must bear in mind that imperialism is a world system, and it must be defeated in a world confrontation. Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. One thing that libertarians and Marxists can directly identify, although with vastly different argumentation, is that imperialism is a world system. Mm-hmm. And where we part ways definitely is looking at the world through the lens of historical realism. That's where that last stage of capitalism comes in.
Yeah, absolutely.
I find it lamentable that libertarian theorists don't have any wide-ranging, easily applicable methods of analysis like historical materialism. I mean, our method of analysis is, do they belong to the state? If so, they're bad. But unfortunately, vastly different definition what a state actor isn't.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I think he kind of very briefly touches on, although not through direct words at the end of that quote there, is where they extract capital, raw materials, technicians, and cheap labor, and they export new capital, instruments of domination, arms, and all kinds of articles, thus submerging us in an absolute dependence. Like, that... Shit, I've already lost my train of thought.
I would think if I were to put my libertarian hat on, he's describing colonialism and the exploitation that comes with it. And
absolutely,
libertarians, although they might not like to talk about it because it's kind of a leftist talking point, but libertarians in general can come to that analysis as well.
I remember where I was going for with this. The broader definition of what a state actor is that Marxists tend to use versus the more typical, like, Western libertarian. So, and that's where that is kind of touching on, is like, corporations as we know them in this day and age are wholly a construct fabrication, whatever you want to call it, of the state system that exists. So their ability to do all of this exploitative enterprises is because they've got the governments of the world saying that they're allowed to.
Now, during this episode, I'm going to challenge that, because we are talking about globalism, and one of the main themes of globalism is that corporations are no longer bound to their sovereign governments. They're multinational.
Right, and I agree with that too. Getting ahead of the conversation a little bit, because to me, okay, let's say if there were, there doesn't really exist like this anymore, but let's say there was some massive corporation that is exclusively an American enterprise. Okay, that's not the case, but let's pretend for the sake of discussion for a moment. The only way they can continue to get away with exploitation in that manner is with the backup of governments of other nations. If they were exclusively an American enterprise, there'd be no way they could do that to anyone except the American people.
Absolutely.
And that's where the globalism portion of all that comes in, and the imperialism, like he's talking about, is like the corporations. When I say they're a state entity, I don't necessarily mean that they are a single state entity. They are an entity that exists in the way they exist because however many different countries they operate in, whether it's 1, 2, or 200, have said, yeah, that's okay, we're going to let you do that. Because at the end of the day, I mean, the states are the guys with the militaries, and if they really wanted to put the thumb screws to a company, they could. But they don't, because it benefits the people that are running the various governments as well.
And so, oftentimes, political interests and economic interests intersect, and that's where you have this class of people. We call them the cathedral, or, you know, the big tech companies, or whatever. You can name 1,000 examples.
Globo homos, whatever. Yeah.
Elite globo homos. They're multinational in nature. They interface across borders. You have one corporation that interfaces with other corporations, and they're all tied in with the machine of the state through lobbying and subsidies and all that. And we as libertarians know all that. But I think in my opinion, at least, Marxists have done a more concise job of naming the enemy than we have, because what I see from libertarians is that we tend to give mid-sized corporations a pass, even though mid-sized corporations and small businesses are also global in nature. They have to be, or they don't survive. They're also, you know, willing or unwillingly, they're participating in this system of globalism and contributing all of its consequences.
I would even argue that a lot of the small to moderate sized companies are doing so unwittingly in a lot of cases. You know, you've got a small boutique, let's say on Main Street, small town USA or something like that, right? You know, they sell clothes. You know, what's so bad about that? Well, half of their clothes are manufactured in China or Indonesia or whatever. And yes, I can already hear many of the extreme right libertarians going, well, yeah, those are made in sweatshops, but the sweatshops are better conditions than the subsistence farming they were doing before that, so those people are leading a better life. And that's not inherently untrue, but that's also not the end of the discussion.
Yeah, they're making $2 more an hour than they would have made. Checkmate.
Yeah, and that's great.
Checkmate, call me.
Yeah, exactly, and that's fantastic. I'm not actually going to argue that them being better off than they would have been otherwise is a bad thing. However, you cannot pretend that that's still not exploitative.
Yeah, and you can't pretend that there's not other tangential consequences to things to things like culture, to things like their environment in particular.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look at their China, ecosystems. For Christ's sake.
Look at what
some of their cities are. That too. That's even worse now. But I'm thinking just air pollution wise, with all the factories and stuff in some of the major Chinese cities. Is like the which one was it? Beijing or something like that? I think that's got the mural up of the skyline, so you can see what the city would look like if it weren't blanketed in smog 24/7.
Yeah, it's the permanent smog cloud, and we have that here as well. Yeah. It wasn't until very, and a lot of it's due to, you know, the fires and all that, but on the West Coast, I mean, you got San Francisco has bad smog days. Every car in California has to get a smog check.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'll excuse things like when there's wildfires and shit raging. It's like, don't get me wrong, some of those wildfires are probably caused by government being stupid and horrendously allowing mismanagement to occur, but they're still wildfires. It's not like it's a factory billowing out smoke or something like that.
Yeah, it's not it might be man-made, but it's not systemic.
Exactly.
Hey, can I pause for a second?
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, the fires haven't been really a consequence of rapid industrialization. Maybe tangentially, and I'm just not thinking about it, but they definitely have been an avenue for more expropriation, more regulation, more expropriation in the form of taxes and fees and water bans and fines and all that shit.
Yeah.
And it's had a cultural effect too, because now if you're seen watering your lawn, on an off day or whatever, and violating the water ban, it's not so much you have to worry about the town hitting you. You have to worry about your neighbor reporting you. You have to worry about people passing you by on the street, like defacing your car. It's stuff like that. I lived in California for 9 years, and like
I'm sorry.
it had its ups and downs. I got to see some fucking very hot mujeres, and that's about the only good thing about the place, the mujeres. So yeah, like we were saying, there are consequences to global capitalism, which I think no matter what definition you use, whether it's the Marxist definition or the neoclassical, there are definite consequences to world trade, world economies, and the level of concentration of power, and whether we would say private businesses or multinational corporations.
Yep. Now, I do want to say one thing just because I feel like I should. And that's, namely, I think in a system absent the state actors that kind of force some of the outcomes that we're seeing for their own benefit, I do think that even still in this modern era with the hyper-connectivity and so forth, that a global capitalist structure as the hard right would define capitalism specifically would be far less, I would say probably almost nil on the exploitation and the repercussions of such a thing would be considerably less. And I mean, let's be honest, you're never going to eliminate negative repercussions from anything, literally anything. They're always going to exist because some humans are shitty, some are good, most are somewhere in between. You know, like there's going to be negative consequences just from everything that you want to try, and I don't pick your poison as far as that's concerned. They're all going to have something. But I do think that in a truly free market, you would see considerably less of these negative consequences that we're seeing in this version of capitalism, and we'll use that word kind of loosely for the moment.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think in general, the rate of industrialization in developed countries, the rate of, exploitation in a purely free market system, vastly slow. Without a currency that you can print at will, without the executive fiat that is military protection, we were the agents of globalization. We ensured the flow of global trade, U.S. dollar. We were agents of that. And I recognize that. I couldn't quite articulate what I was doing, but I just knew it was wrong.
Yeah.
And I think I mentioned that in the first episode of Boys Town. And
I seem to recall it.
Yeah. And when that happens, you create a class of people that are at least parallel to the political actors that we as libertarians don't like very much. This is this class of people, they call it the transnational capitalist class from the left. That term was kind of fleshed out by, believe it or not, a UC Santa Barbara professor of sociology named William I. Robinson. And it might blow your mind to know this, but he's a Marxist.
What?
I know. A UC Santa Barbara sociology professor is a Marxist?
No. But he does, it ain't so.
He does raise a good point. And
sure.
And in coining this term, the transnational capitalist class, he says, and I quote, "Transnational capital is not faceless. A transnational capitalist class, TCC," I think we can just shorten that to Jews. Is that all right to you?
Yeah, sure. Why not? It's your show.
All right. "Made up of the owners and managers of transnational capital, has emerged as the agent of global capitalism. Its interests lie in promoting global, not national, circuits of accumulation. Among the many developments facilitating this cross-integration of capitalist groups around the world into a Jew, the massive expansion of TNCs, transnational capitalists, and spread of their affiliates has played a major role, along with transnational ownership of these companies' capital shares. Other important developments include the phenomenal growth in foreign direct investment, an equally phenomenal increase in cross-border mergers and acquisitions, the interlocking of boards of directors, the spread of joint border ventures and strategic alliances of all sorts, the spread to most countries of the world of stock exchanges trading transnational capital shares, and increasing global outsourcing and subcontracting networks. The giant corporate conglomerates that drive the global economy have ceased to be corporations of a particular country and have increasingly come to represent transnational capital." Now, if you take out like all the leftist jargon, it seems like this could have been written by like some alt-right guy.
Oh, very much so.
So
very much so.
It's just different syntax, different vocabulary. Right. The skepticism of globalism is present on both the far left and the far right.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a very warranted skepticism, because, I mean, if you're not noticing the cudgels of power that the giant conglomerates and corporations are wielding, at this point, you're just not fucking paying attention. I mean, and they treat quote-unquote national borders like a substantial number of libertarians believe they should be treated, which is as if they don't exist. I mean, the one example I can think of, and this is, in the grand scheme of things, a pretty minor example, really, but this was, 5 years ago, maybe, something like that. Fucking Burger King was looking at buying, who was it, like, Tim Hortons or something like that, and then relocating their headquarters up to Canada, just because it was better for them from tax perspectives.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Ireland is a big tax haven as well, and it's affected their culture.
Absolutely, massively. I mean, you can make arguments as to whether or not that cultural affectation is good or bad, and there's arguments for both, to be perfectly frank. But to say that it hasn't done it is, again, like if you're going to honestly say that, you just haven't been paying attention.
Yeah, there's nothing libertarian about using the free market to enforce cultural hegemony.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, there's nothing libertarian about using the free market to enforce literally anything, but especially something like that.
Yeah, and, you know, you have to understand that technically these are market actors, and market actors in the sense that, you know, maybe they wouldn't exist in their current form, but there would be, like you said, they would exist. They would exist in a free market. They just maybe wouldn't be as effective. They wouldn't be as consequential.
Yeah, or all-encompassing, or whatever terminology you want to use.
Yep.
You know, McDonald's, just to continue using fast food, because they're very easy examples to look at.
Because we're very Americans. Easy to look at.
Well, no, it's name something more omnipresent than fast food.
Yeah,
and I mean
McDonald's,
and I mean globally.
Yep.
So, I mean, they're very easy examples to look at, and they're very non-controversial in a lot of ways. But, I mean, you think about it. Okay, McDonald's got huge, or started getting huge, because they offered a product that really was in a pretty free market. And the food service industry specifically is probably one of the freer sections of the market still to this day. I mean, I had this conversation with somebody, I don't know, a week ago maybe, when we were discussing intellectual property. I'm like, look at the food and drink industries, man. IP doesn't need to exist because all you have to do is do something better. And McDonald's is a great example of that. You know, like, they probably would still have gotten huge, but I don't know that they would even somebody like them would necessarily be as big as they were, or are, I should say, in a truly free market setting, because it's a hell of a lot easier to start competing.
They wouldn't have as much capital investment as they did in a completely freed market, because there's, like I said, you just can't hit the printing press. There's no printing press to hit.
Yep, exactly. Well, and I mean, even in an industry like food service, where you don't have IP protections on things, I mean, you've got some trademark registration, but that's incidental for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have IP protections. You don't have all this other shit. Like, I could compete with McDonald's tomorrow tomorrow. Yeah, on a local level. Tomorrow, with minimal effort, there's minimal government interference on any kind of level.
Yeah, you know, and your only risk would be them buying you out.
Yeah, which is, in a lot of cases, considered a win in this day and age.
Yeah, but absolutely.
You know, once they did reach a certain point, even somebody like them, they do start wielding that governmental cudgel some. You know, they do begin to lobby for legislation that helps protect them. Somebody like that, it's minimal, but it's still there, man.
Yeah.
They're still, and I mean, trademark, the thing I kind of dismissed a moment ago. That's a big one.
Yeah.
Trademark is a big thing for them.
That is cultural influence. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That is a state enforced cultural influence. If you put two big yellow arches on the side of your restaurant, you will have people there like telling you to take it down or get thrown in a cage.
Unless the rest of it is significantly different enough from their sign as to not be in any way confusing.
And as somebody who is familiar with Marxism, not a Marxist, but somebody who's familiar with it, I think McDonald's is a perfect example of the stages of history that they talk about. If you just look at McDonald's in that context, they started out as a local restaurant. They beat out their competition on a local level. Then they expanded to the county, beat out the competition there. At least enough, they accrued enough capital to spread to the county, accrued enough capital to spread to the state, accrued enough capital to spread to the country. Now they're accruing enough capital to spread to the world. Now, a Marxist would say, well, monopolies are rare because you have to accrue enough capital to spread globally and completely extract capital from everywhere on the globe. So that's why monopolies are rare to a Marxist. Libertarian would say monopolies are rare in a free market because, you know, you have competition, you have to provide your own protection, your own, private legal systems, all that. So again, we arrive at the same conclusion, but they're vastly different argument.
Yeah. Thought processes to get there are considerably different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, my whole goal is just to kind of introduce libertarianism to just a more methodical way of thinking. And right now, the best thing I got happens to be just variations of Marxism, adapting Marxism to anarchism less.
It is the one thing I have heard said from many a person who has read Marx, which I freely admit I have not. I probably will not, because I've read precisely zero libertarian theory on either side. I kind of intend on keeping it that way for the most part. But the one, not criticism, what the hell is the word I'm looking for? I don't know what word I'm looking for, but the one thing people say about Marx that from the little I know of him, I am inclined to agree with, is that his critiques are excellent. His conclusions are idiotic.
Yep. Yeah. And he was,
I'm inclined to agree with that.
Yeah, the critiques of Marxism outmaneuvered the critiques of Marx, but to no avail, because here we are right now. We have some fucking hellscape of taking all the bad parts of Marxism and applying it to bourgeois neoliberals.
Yeah. I think that's probably one of the things that amuses me on a Schadenfreude level the most, is these bougie idiots adopting Marxism when it's just like, you're what he was talking about.
Yeah, did you hear about one of the higher ups in one of the BLM organizations just bought like 4 properties?
Yes, I heard about this and I laughed. Yeah. Real hard. I'm not even gonna lie. When I saw that she
literally reaction taking over a popular socialist move.
It was so beautiful. It was poetry in motion. It's like this woman screeching, you know, Black Lives Matter, the organization.
Black Landlords, you know, Matter.
One of its founder. And she buys a $1.2 million home in one of the whitest neighborhoods that she can find. It's just like, oh, it couldn't get any better. Like, do you guys get it yet? Yeah. They don't care about you. They don't care about you at all.
They're going to ride your aesthetics to the bank.
Mm-hmm. And boy, howdy, did she. And you know what?
Yeah.
On one hand, good for her.
Yeah, good for honor.
Her. I respect the hustle. On the other hand, the guillotine doesn't know color.
Yep. The guillotine is equal opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, I hope to one day get there. Did you want to throw out any plugs?
Sure. We'll do the couple that I've got. So you can come find me, follow me on Twitter, at least for the time being, at Corsair Michelle, at CorsairMichel. I say for the time being because I am another one of those oft-banned individuals. I usually make it somewhere between 6 months to a year. This account just started, so we should be good for another 3-4 months at least.
That's how you know you're putting in work.
Yeah. I threaten a lot of people with violence, let's just say.
That's not very in accordance with the non-aggression principle.
Yeah, I don't care. I don't give a shit.
That is the correct attitude.
I don't care. I would honestly say, if I had to throw a label onto myself, I'm probably a lot closer to Stirner's egoism than I am anything else. So, I don't care.
Yep. I hate spooks too.
Yep. In whichever definition you want to use.
Well, thanks for coming on, man.
And also, I do have a website real quick. TheStatelessCook.com. I blog there occasionally. I have links to my YouTube channel there where I do some cooking videos occasionally. And I am documenting the transforming of the property that we have moved out to onto a fully functioning 3.3 acre homestead.
Oh, that's badass.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking sweet, let me tell you.
Yeah, looking forward to seeing how that develops. And once again, thank you very much for coming on.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you for having me.
Do you want to tell everybody the way in which you happen to be on the show?
Well, I'm sure they already knew. But yeah, so I'm not going to say the word again because it just makes me a little uncomfortable. Huh. But I
can't empathize at all with that.
I know you can't.
Go on.
Also, I'm trying to make Bird's life a little easier when he edits. I called you the N-word in your DMs after you posted that the 13th and the 50th people to do that would get a guest spot on your show, and I was number 13.
Lucky number 13.
A fun bit of trivia, that actually is my lucky number. So I thought that was amusingly appropriate.
Hit up the liquor store and play that tonight.
I might.
All right, man, I'll see you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, no problem. Happy Friday, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Aaron, this is Boys Town with Aaron, and today I have one Lee Enfield, the owner and proprietor of N-Block Press, here to talk about globalism. I want to open up right away, Lee, with a quote from Karl Kautsky, a prominent Marxist thinker in the late 19th century. But there is a limit to the extension of the markets. There have been periods during the last 30 years when it has not gone on. True enough, the field over which capitalist production can extend itself is immense. It leaps over all local and national boundaries. It has the whole globe for its market. but capitalism has virtually reduced the size of the globe. Only 100 years ago, the market for capitalist industry was limited to the western parts of Europe and certain coastlands and islands almost exclusively dominated by England. But such was the vigor and greed of the capitalists, and so gigantic were the means at their disposal, that since then, almost all countries on Earth have been forced open, not to the products of England alone, but to those of all capitalist nations. Today, there are hardly any other markets to be opened, except those from which little is to be fetched besides fever and blows. What do you think about that, Lee?
Well, I would say that we're here.
Yeah, fever and blows.
Right. Right, that's a lot of that going around these days.
And to my listeners that are going to spurg out about the use of the word capitalism, it's fine. It really is. By capitalism, Marxists always mean the fusion between the state and the market and market actors, and especially those market actors that manage to acquire large chunks of market share and the relation that goes on with them.
Yeah, I think people will hopefully be all right. You know, I know that's tough to hear, but
you'd be surprised. It's just a different working definition. I'm sorry, all right? I'm sorry that I'm a Marxist-Leninist.
Yeah.
Talking about fever and blows. I mean,
yeah, this is what this is 100 years ahead of his time or so. But you really can't deny that we're at this point. I mean, especially, it's greatly accelerated since COVID. The middle class is gone. The idea of something being not, operating outside of a globalist economy doesn't exist. I mean, it's basically impossible to be a player at this point, right? I mean,
yeah, even a small player.
Yeah. It's scary times. It's uncertain. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, a way forward, or how you think, the right, the left, the every person can, move forward, thrive, anything like that. Cause it's pretty bleak out there.
Yeah. I mean, you think about, that common summary by Mises, iPencil. Or is it, it's not Mises, it's, who is it? He like goes through the production of a pencil and where all the materials for the pencil comes from. And they come from everywhere around the world just to make a pencil. And that's supposed to be the miracle of the global market. But it doesn't stop there. That pencil takes, the board members for the pencil company are from various nations, various cultures. The shipping companies, all of the steps of production and distribution and sale are all multinational. None of those players in that process are beholden to any type of sovereign law. You could say that they're beholden to many different sovereign laws and they do their due diligence, but no, they write those laws. Maybe not the pencil company, but the pharmaceutical company, the computer chip manufacturing companies, the tech companies that use them. When you hear the right wing talk about like a global cabal, it might not be technically part of the quote unquote cathedral, but CEOs and oligarchs that run these companies, they're definitely, maybe tangentially beneficiaries of that cathedral.
Yeah, right. Of course. I mean, it's frustrating, to see people, wig out when you use the term like, global cabal, and they think you're like a conspiracy theorist. They don't understand that it's the reference to like the lizard people is tongue in cheek for exactly this kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's frustrating, that, they just kind of refuse to, understand that and consider it. I mean, okay, so we're here. So what's next? Like, I mean, if this guy's right, you know what I mean? Like globalism has predictably, cracked into every market. You see it everywhere you go. You can't escape it. It's not all necessarily, economic policies. I mean, social policies as well. I mean, you can't go, you know, I mean, the whole cancel culture meme, that has meaningful impacts on mom and pop shops, small players that cannot, you know, not just defend themselves against, you know, woke capital, but, you know, can't influence it either. I mean, they don't have a seat at the table and they don't have a shield against it. I mean, who, other than the CEOs, the oligarchs that you mentioned, I mean, who is benefiting from this?
I mean, like you said, the small businesses, I mean, the petty bourgeoisie, they are, in many cases, they don't have a choice but to be some of the worst players because they're in a race to the bottom to maximize profits to compete. So when you want to talk about like, oh, well, where am I going to source my t-shirts from? It has to be the cheapest Chinese sweatshop you can find.
Yeah, right. Right. I mean, there's no way around it, but like why, you know, I mean, why do we have to live like this? Like what's, you know, what kind of tools would be effective against something that's so insidious and has its, you know, its fingers in every pie, so to speak?
That's a great question. And I think we can learn a lot from how movements in the global South are kind of combating this, especially Africa, South America. They've done a pretty decent job of maximizing the material benefits they can get from global multinationals. If you look at a lot of, I'm trying to think of any movements in particular. Oh, the Zapatistas in Mexico. They're kind of half anarchist, half Marxist-Leninist, but
right. They,
and it's going to suck to hear for libertarians, but they've done a very good job of minimizing the consequences of globalism, maintaining their culture, while also being, for the most part, a direct democratic entity. Anything that they bring in has to be voted on. Like all those trade deals have to be voted on, majority vote by the people or whatever. Anything that they, any profit that they generate from like the coffee that they export, that all gets distributed because everybody's involved in the production in one way or the other. And that is textbook Marxism. And that, right. I mean, other than like, you know, being a rogue nation like North Korea or Iran or whatever, I say rogue nation, I shouldn't say that. Being resistant to fucking Western imperialism necessitates having a closed economy, necessitates having, you know, a strong, the left would say or not even the left, liberals would call it fascism, but it would require institutional protections for culture. And
Right. But I mean, I mean, that's obviously the challenge is, you know, finding
the balance. Know,
some type of analogous movement, you know, here.
I think the way forward is just Sharia law.
Well, I mean, right. I mean, we all convert to Islam. And right. Yeah. Look, I'm not going to stop the you know, unstoppable tide of Islam or anything. that's not why I'm here. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. We're all about the prophet. Praise be his name. Peace be upon him.
Right. Like, like any good socialist, I understand that there's a transitionary period before full Islamofascism. Like, don't get me wrong. We all want the same thing here.
As far as my idea goes, I'm an accelerationist. I say, you know, put everything they do under a magnifying glass. If they're like in India right now, they're undergoing a lot of civil unrest because the farmers are, and France as well, almost an identical situation. The farmers, the agricultural players are pissed because they either stop subsidies or cut subsidies to you know, whatever crops they grow. I think France it's wheat. And they're threatening to take away their social safety net and ensure that they have a, you know, that they're not going to get fucked by a downturn in whatever their crop prices are. And they're out there in the street, like fighting with cops, dumping manure all over the fucking public buildings, all over the government buildings. And, you know, I don't think we'll ever see anything like that here because, Most of the farmers here are owned by fucking Bayer, not Monsanto, Bayer.
Right.
Or they're like subcontractors or whatever. They use their seeds and they're in some way affected by the agricultural oligopoly. And as long as they get their fucking subsidies from the Farm Bureau, they're fine.
Well, right. But I mean, the American farmer has to have those subsidies because, you know, we have such a system of excess that, you know, growing something like corn or grain is not going to be profitable unless you sell it at a global scale and you get subsidized by the federal government. I mean, it's a really bizarre, it's a weird way that like the U.S. government has been effective at kind of neutralizing like the farmer's ability to cause problems.
The sickle part of the hammer and sickle is absent.
Right. Because they can't, you know, really can't afford not to. Like you can't run, you know, at scale any type of profitable farm without, you know, without those government subsidies. Like most communities have, at least, you know, I shouldn't say that most, I think a lot of communities, I know where I live, there's like, there's independent farms that grow like non-GMO foods that you know, create like organic, like vegetables and stuff like that, that you can buy directly from, as a consumer, which I do, you know, down where I'm at, in the South, but that doesn't work at like a national scale. You know what I mean? Like, cause you can't compete against, people with, you know, these, you know, high tech farming and the crop yield that you're going to get from GMO, you know, stock. So, I mean, it's tough. Like in France, if the farmers are unhappy with it, you know, presumably, I don't know anything about the French, you know, agricultural economy, but I mean, there has to, like, if they're removing their social safety net and they're reacting like that, I would like to think that something similar could happen here, but I don't think the U.S. government would be foolish enough, you know, necessarily at this point to stop the subsidies that keep farmers compliant, you know, because I mean, it's, you know, your average, you know, coastal elite doesn't have too high an opinion of the American farmer. Their flyover states, you know, I mean, there's just like an open disgust, you know, from these people towards people who live in the Midwest. So, you know, that's its own separate problem.
But as an accelerationist, that presents a good opportunity because we are. And I hate to say it again, cause I've been saying it, not even me, but like everybody's been saying it for years, like, oh, we're due for a downturn. We're due for a recession. We're due for a depression. And the next, like it's coming, like the fucking rug's going to get pulled from under us. The housing market's going to blow up, all that shit. It hasn't happened yet. And I'm steadily coming around to maybe it's not going to happen. Maybe they finally cracked the code of how to just print infinite money.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, basically it works because everybody kind of wants it to work, like most people, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like you're, any large company, of course, wants, you know, U.S. monetary policy to continue at this rate because it's ridiculous. You know, but like, let's do this. Let me challenge you on acceleration. Is that okay?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I heard a take that I thought was interesting, you know, somewhere out, that was kind of a critique of accelerationism, and it was, to paraphrase, it was basically like, okay, well, let's accelerationism. So you're up on the 14th, 15th floor of a building and you say, fuck this, I'm tired of it. I want to get back to the ground floor. You know, you could go down the stairs or you could take the accelerationist route and jump out the window. Mm-hmm. And, you know, either way you get back to the ground floor where you want to go. But if you're an accelerationist, you know, you're fucking dead because you jumped out the window. Like, what does... So why, like, okay, let's put everything under a microscope that they're doing, draw attention to it, things like that. But to what end? Like, why? What? So you jump out that window, you say, look at this, this is bullshit. Like, what comes next? What's the upshot?
Well, the trick is to have it so that you're not the one jumping out the window. You're getting everybody that you hate to jump out the window. You're saying, look, there's the ground right there. That the fastest way to get to the ground and get out of this fucking building is to get out of this window. So,
this really does come back to Sharia law.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, you know, you're gay, you're trans, you're an apostate. You need to get to the ground and I'm going to help you. I'm doing you a favor.
Right. This is for you, not for me.
No, but this all comes back to fucking Leninism. You need an elite group in any political movement. There needs to be some elite, like, intelligent, true believers to direct the flow of anger, to direct the flow of activism, direct the flow of violence. And like, we as libertarians are so far away from that ideologically that, I mean, if we could kind of crack that code, there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of fucking potential to do without Fed posting too much. We probably have the most potential. We just don't have the organization to democratically enact reforms.
Right, because there's kind of like from a, you know, a libertarian standpoint, there's no real there's not like a safe, open way to talk about what doing the work looks like.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like if you're, you know, if you're BLM, which is an incredibly effective organization, you know, you can just go on TV and say like, look, Ben, we just want to go out in the street and burn all this shit down and say, fuck you.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, you know, the corporations, Amazon, Walmart, Target, they're kind of skewed because they can't push back because they know they're going to get a fucking brick through the window. It's like, look, there's like an 80% chance you're going to get a brick through the window anyway. But if we think that you're not, you know, going to at least posture like you support us, you're definitely getting the brick through the window. You know what I mean? So there's a lot of power there. Like, you know, like think about, you know, like what are the raw materials for this type of event, for any type of meaningful political change? Like, you need money, you need numbers, and you need a willingness to commit violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, ideally, you have those in, you know, an effective ratio, you know, and you know, that
one would say 3%.
Like, right.
One might say.
Right. Right. I mean,
exactly. Which is about what the popular vote is for the Libertarian Party.
Yeah. Right. And you can have history has shown time and time again, you can have a disproportionately outsized effect with a small percentage. I mean, just look at murders. If 13% can do 50%.
Highly effective.
kidding.
This is why we need more diversity in the party, really.
Right. Exactly. You know?
Tired of all these fucking white people.
It's mayo monkeys unwilling to just burn the calories required to do what is needed.
But yeah,
I mean,
you, like you said, you have historical examples time and time again where a small vocal minority is able to accomplish their goals just by being vocal, you know, both in peaceful and non-peaceful methods. I mean, I'm thinking in particular the Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks were a minority for a very long time, but they had a small group of highly intelligent, motivated true believers to direct the peasants towards their enemies and frame their enemies in such a way that any peasant could understand why they're the enemy and go from there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for any type of effective pushback against globalism and progressivism, which tend to move hand in hand, you know, we, you know, on the right kind of need to figure out what that messaging looks like. You know what I mean? Because like there are ineffective or less effective groups on the left. BLM is very effective, but like Antifa is not very effective. Like overall, you know what I mean? They have a tremendous willingness to commit violence, but they don't really have the numbers, and they don't really have the cash flow.
They don't have the willingness to sustain violence.
Right. Or really to, you know, kind of commit. So like there's a difference, and we saw this at that courthouse up in, I think it was Oregon. You remember last year when, you know, everybody was out there shining lasers at the cops and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were those like fucking unmarked vans picking everybody up and that kind of deal. Like Antifa in that context, it's not really bringing, any violence. Like they're bringing unrest, but you know, they were willing to walk right up to the fence, but they weren't really, you know, willing to, you know, breach that barrier. You know what I mean? Like, you know,
you're knowing about, like, full well that they could have. It's, I don't know. Right. Like, I know that there are professional, like, agent provocateurs that embed themselves in all of those instances of unrest. And I wish their goals were a little loftier.
Yeah, right. And like, you know, not to Fed post, but it's like, you're not really accomplishing anything by just getting tear gassed for the next 40 fucking nights. You know what I mean? Like you're kind of an idiot if you just walk up to a fence and get hit with paintballs and tear gas. You know, for like 6 weeks, like, you know, like, why would you do that? Like, you're not affecting any meaningful change. You didn't disband Border Patrol. You know what I mean? Like those guys, you know, did not lose the fight. The courthouse is still there, right? Like, people are still facing federal charges. So like, it can be ineffective. Like, the component of willingness just to get out in the street and cause a problem does not always lend itself. In fact, I would say that it's probably, that type of thing being effective is probably the exception to the rule. I mean, there's been a handful of great revolutions in modern history, but there's been a shitload of people just getting their asses beat by the cops for acting wrong. You know what I mean? So, like, the component of a willingness to be violent is, you know, that's certainly a part of it, but
they haven't figured out that the veracity of violence matters. You know, the method of violence matters.
Right. Your killer instinct matters. Like there's, you know, and this is something I haven't emailed it yet, 'cause I haven't like finished it, but this is something I've got like a Substack article going about, you know, we don't have to get too far into it, but essentially, I think, because we saw it on January 6th, too, where people are willing to go cause a ruckus and they're willing to, like, you know, make some noise and posture like they're threatening, but ultimately they're not willing to, like, pull the trigger.
Yes, yes.
Like, I think that to some extent in America, like, we're kind of animals living in captivity who have forgotten how to kill their prey.
Yes, because within that captivity, we're fed, you know, GMO fucking grain. We're given a pat on the ass every once in a while. We're trained, you know, to be zoo animals. It'd be nice,
right? Fucking and respectable we live in constant surveillance. Like, you know, it's cliche, but if you go back to the concept of the panopticon, like, we're under constant surveillance, and that is, I mean, that's a form of captivity, right?
Yeah.
Like, you might be able to drive, maybe, depending on where you live, you might be able to hop in your car and drive up to the supermarket to buy some dinner. Maybe, you know, like, I can because I live in Florida. But, like, people listening to this in California or Michigan or New York can't, you know, depending on how strict the literally the order from the governor to stay in your own home. Like, you live in captivity. When you get there, you have to be wearing, you know, your mask. There's talk about, you know, these vaccine passports, all this type of thing. Like, most people, regardless of, you know, political ideology, we all live in this type of captivity that has been fostered in by globalism. Because, yes, like you mentioned, the synergy in terms of capitalism, like the synergy between the state and the private corporations, that in effect has created this surveillance state, you know, and I say that distinctly from a police state, but a surveillance state where, like, Amazon, who hosts, you know, the DOD on their web, you know, AWS, like their web servers, Amazon, who has massive DOD contracts, also has all the purchasing, watching, search habits, location data of every person with a smartphone, and we're paying $99 a year for the privilege of, you know, of having access to that, right? So like we all live under like this type of captivity. And I think that it created a situation where, like captive animals, we might act out sometimes, but we don't necessarily have that killer instinct needed to actually make change. Like, think about, you remember the movie Free Willy, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. So for any, you know, we're both old, but for anybody, any Zoomers listening, you know, there's this fucking killer whale. It lives in SeaWorld. It's captive. You know, it doesn't like it, blah, blah, blah. It's a whole big, you know, feel good thing. And at the end of the movie, the whale breaks out of captivity and swims off into the ocean. Right. And the movie stops and it's like, hooray, the whale is free. You know, the good guys won, blah, blah, blah. But in real life, like, I mean, that's based on a true story. And the whale really did leave captivity. But when it got out into the ocean, open ocean, it fucking died of pneumonia very quickly because it didn't know how to catch food and it got rejected by the other whales. Like this, you know, this giant killer whale swam out there. The other whales were like, okay, like, I don't know why you're trying to be friends with us. Like, you seem like kind of a fucking faggot. Go back to where you came from. The whale went and tried to like re-communicate with humans. Like it went to like a port, you know, looking for like fish or something, you know, it was unsuccessful and it just went, you know, it just went out of the ocean and died.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like what happened on January 6th, right? Like,
yeah, they got into the Capitol building and they're like, oh shit.
They broke free.
Pictures, I guess.
Right. They broke free from captivity. You know, they, you know, made a run for the open ocean. And when they got there, they realized that they forgot yeah. how to kill their own fish.
Yep.
Because they're used to their trainers giving them fish.
I mean, they take a selfie and no one was with there. This cop and, oh, shit, they shot
right.
me.
Right. No one was there. No one was there to give them permission mm-hmm. to catch their own prey. And so they didn't do it.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. It's the same thing with Antifa. We saw that outside that courtroom or the courthouse in Oregon. And honestly, it's the same thing with BLM. Like, BLM did not go destroy the Minneapolis Police Department and say, look, here's the deal. You know, if they wanted to say, like, look, abolish the police, we don't want to live like this, which is their right as a human being. Like, they can say, look, we talked it over as a community. You're not allowed to come to my house with a fucking gun and tell me what to do anymore. And here's the deal. I'm going to go burn your shit down. And if for one fucking second you guys put a badge on and think you can come into my neighborhood and tell me how to live, I'm going to fucking take action about this in a violent, final sense. They didn't do that. You know, they could have done that. They didn't. You know, Antifa could have done something about that courthouse. They didn't. MAGA team could have done something on January 6th, and they didn't.
And this is a, Antifa especially is a uniquely American failure. Whereas Antifa, if you look at Europe, especially in the Eastern Bloc, like former Eastern Bloc, Antifa is a force to be reckoned with. Like, their governments do not want to piss off their hard leftists because they right. will go out and they will burn shit. And it's not even a question. It's like, if you, it like their governments are more afraid of violent left-wing activism than they are of, you know, their fucking right-wing, you know, complaining about shit.
Yeah, no, they really are. And no one even, you know, tries to stop them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they, you know, like if they go out and just beat up the Sweden Democrats, you know, for being right wing and, you know, they complain about it. It's like, okay, well, you know, oh, well, that's what happens. You know, Antifa just goes out and beats your ass. What do you want me to do about it?
Yeah.
You know, the end, like it doesn't matter. It is a, you know, an American failure, just like any protest movement of, you know, what we've talked about, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, BLM, not really, you know, I mean, the story's not finished there, but
it's, you know, it's looking exactly... like, it's looking like they're, starting to kowtow to the more neoliberal faction of,
yeah, of course, because they're ultimately like where all these things go wrong, minus, you know, to a lesser extent, Antifa, but with both, you know, the MAGA boomers on January 6th, and with BLM, these are people that are protesting ultimately not to win, but just to have a seat at the table.
Yep.
Right? Like that's what's going on. They're not saying like, hey, fuck this, we're doing our own thing. They're saying, hey, you know, fuck you guys. We need to be more involved with, you know, this neoliberal globalist hellscape that you've produced.
Yeah. And that's we're not getting the same American thing. Liberals across the world have always, like since the 60s at least, have placed inclusivity at the top of their to-do list. And in doing that, right. They have given more people, they have given more ethnic minorities in other countries seats at the table, but they've also, you know, killed and imprisoned a lot more by a large margin. So
Right. Because they make getting included, you know, they view that as like the goal, and it's like, no, I don't want to be included in this.
Yeah.
Like this, I want to be ignored by this. Like I want this to have no power over me. Mm-hmm. That's the goal. Not, you know, being included at the table.
Yeah. Yeah. I want my own table, which is, you know, if you look again, back in like the 60s, if you look at like Malcolm X, Huey P. Newton, all the liberation movements, if you compare them to the liberation movements of now, they're just like shadows of their former self. BLM is not a black liberation movement. It's a black inclusivity movement, which the end goal is to be treated like white people.
Right. No, it really is. It's like we're, you know, it's like having a prison riot with the hopes of ending up being cool with the prison guard.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Like. Yeah, like okay, you know, like why are you doing this? You know what I mean? It's very bizarre, but that's like
you've seen it happen time and time again across the world with subcultures. You know, a subculture is oppressed for generation after generation, and then they gradually make inroads into the mainstream, and then they just become like an amalgamous blob with everybody else, and they don't have a culture anymore, and then they become stagnant, and then. You know, now they're fucking bitching about, like, give your 5-year-old hormone replacement therapy.
Well, right. Yeah, because, you know, I think it's just maybe it's the incentive structure of it, because that seems to be what we're talking about, is, like, if the incentive is to be cool with the prison guard, if the incentive is to have some type of shred of representation in, you know, the cog of this, you know, hell machine, like, I would say it's a misaligned incentive, which seems to be, you know, a big problem, but like, you know, what's the messaging to make that clear to people? Like, how do you tell people that like, no, all the stuff that you enjoy is secretly like a very deliberate and disgusting byproduct of massive systems of control designed to make you complicit and complacent?
Yeah. I mean, all you can do is shout it at the top of the mountain for now until it's time to fucking, you know, rack the shotgun, I guess.
Right.
Not, I mean, not the Fed post.
Right. But I mean, like, you know, I mean, I really think that, like,
I've had the most success attacking people from further than where they are. So, like, attacking the left from the position of the far left, attacking the right from the position of the far right. And I think I'd like to think I've managed to at least get people to question their views, to get to radicalize just maybe a little bit more. And that's the other thing I'm all about, is just gutting out the center and forcing them to the fringe. And it's not that hard to do, because a lot of people materially, they might have the basics. Like, everybody pretty much has a car. Everybody pretty much has a roof over their heads. We all have TVs. We all have a smartphone. So materially, we're not bad off compared to some other places in the world. So unfortunately, our job is a lot harder, because in order to get somebody to radicalize, they have to feel victimized. They have to feel victimized by the system. And neoliberals have done an excellent job of making people feel victimized by the system, and they often are, of applying individuals' experience with power structure to taking those experiences and applying them to the entire group. And that's what I'm trying to do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, that is the problem. Like, that's, you run into a situation yeah. where it's like, okay, well, what if they like the corn syrup?
Yeah.
You know, like
Duncan Lemp gets shot in his home while he's asleep. That could be any one of you. You know, I could say that to conservatives all the time, and I usually don't get a whole lot of pushback.
Yeah, but like, how do you turn that into everyday, like, practical action at the store, at the gas station, at work?
It takes,
like, at some point.
It takes a lot of nuance.
You have to say, you can't, right, but like, it doesn't work. Like,
you,
the nuance.
You can't drop an N-bomb right off the bat. You have to gradually test the waters to see if they'd be offended if you drop an N-bomb. And if they are, then maybe you drop a mayo monkey or a cracker or something. But it's a delicate right. process, because I do it. I do it in real life all the time. My mom was like a fucking, she's like a, you know, non-denominational, but very, very like up with her faith. And I've over the years been telling her, like, look, I hate everybody. Like, you know, she'll bitch and moan about something Trump did. And I'm like, yeah, well, you know, Trump is just a symptom of the problem, and just keep that up. And then she's like, you know, I'm not really that thrilled about Biden now. And I'm like, yeah, what do you mean? We're supposed to be united. And like, you have to approach each individual with, you know, something that you know for a fact is going to just push their needle a little further every interaction. And now my mom's talking about, like, fucking, you know, literal pot-bellied vampires. So, mission accomplished. And then, like,
yeah,
at work,
right. I mean,
too. Like, I work with a lot
of
blue-collar...
Work is a that's a target-rich environment.
It is, yeah. And it's especially if you work with a lot of, like, blue-collar type people, they're usually already, like, leaning kind of populist. And if you can just push them a little bit every day... And look, no one of us is going to do anything. Like, it's going to take all of the initiated, all of the radicals from the right and the left to do their small part to just push the needle on every individual that they can in a certain direction, whether on social media and on real life, especially in real life, because it's usually their community.
Yeah, right. So where, you know, at what point does that translate, like, going back to, like, a Zapatista army, like, where does that translate? Like, what's the inroad, you know? Because, I mean, America is so, Idpol dominates every discussion to the point where it's like, how do you form a, you know, like, a common identity? Like, it used to be in days past where it's like, hey, look, you know, we don't have to agree, but, I'm sure everybody agrees in the freedom of speech, right?
Yeah.
It used to be that was pretty safe to say, but at this point, the answer is no. It's like, no, I don't believe in free speech at all.
Well,
what the fuck are you a Nazi? Like, why would free speech be important to you? You know,
you have to be able to know your audience and who you're communicating with, where they're coming from ideologically, in order to communicate with them. Like, I cannot,
right.
I can't use the same vocabulary when I'm talking to a right-wing anarchist that I use with, say, a left-wing anarchist. Like, that's totally
right,
different tradition.
Yeah, but I'm talking about getting away from rhetorical tools and persuasion more towards just, like, dominating spaces.
That's easy. Just persistence. If you get banned, like, Twitter's a perfect example. A lot of people, when they get banned, they're like, ah, fuck it, I'm off this platform anyways. No, that's
right,
the exact wrong approach. You need to be the right wing lost the culture war. That's done. So now we're in the insurgency phase. And as gay as it is to say, like, we have to be social media insurgents. I know that's like cringe as fuck to say that, and I hate that I have to say it. But we have to be like the fucking gadfly that constantly is there reminding people that, yes, I will drop an N-bomb on your fucking, you know, your mundane CNN post about a fucking bakery competition or whatever.
Yeah, right. I mean,
and that's easy to do for people, and it's practical, and it gets, you know, it's a serotonin rush when people get angry, and that's what we need to chase, that fucking serotonin rush when we make neoliberals angry.
Yeah, I mean, I do love that, you know, but I mean, I don't know, like, I maybe, I don't know, maybe I feel like a renewed optimism about, you know, like, meat space politics, because, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, I have Ron DeSantis as a governor, so all Ron DeSantis has done in the last year is just really annoy the fuck out of liberals, everyone. That's even slightly left of center. I mean, in Florida, like, did you know that in Florida it's legal to run over a protester if they're blocking your way?
That's amazing. And that's...
Yeah, he signed it. It's an executive order. Like, he just came out and was like, look, you know, here's the deal. If there's no reasonable, you know, avenue of escape and you're blocked in by, you know, and you feel like you're in danger, it's, you know...
You're authorized to use deadly force.
Yeah. Yeah, you can just drive right on through him.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's signed, you know, there's an executive order against vaccine passports, you know, shit like that. I mean, you know, I mean, the guy's a politician, so I'm not going to,
yeah,
you know, fanboy him too hard. But, you know, he came out, pissed everybody off.
And he's made more progress than he has otherwise.
Yeah, and I really think... You know, it's important to remember to an extent that a lot of this stuff is fake. Mm-hmm. Like we're talking about things that are made up. Like the idea of like non-binary gender stuff. Like it's fake. It's not real. It doesn't exist. Like you're male or you're female. The end. That's just where it stops. I don't care if people choose like to live otherwise. Like it doesn't bother me.
No.
It's somewhere there's somebody who, like, you know, I don't know, doesn't feel that way, but, you know, it's not true. It doesn't matter. But I mean, like, Ron DeSantis is, you know, his stuff saying, look, we're just not going to do this. The answer is no. How about that? The answer is no. And if you don't like it, you fucking kill yourself.
Yeah.
Like that's a pretty good way to start.
It is.
You know what I mean?
And
like, I feel like,
I hope that, like, I know he's getting a lot of pushback nationally, and if he doesn't get assassinated, there'll be something that fucking ruins him, because there always is.
Yeah, right. There has to be, because and the guy's got a pedigree. I mean, he went to Yale. He was like attached to the Navy SEALs in Iraq and shit. Like the guy's, you know, the guy's got a backstory that's, you know, from a political standpoint,
yeah, passes pretty flawless, the litmus test.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, his alternative was Andrew Gillum, and he ended up, you know, I mean, he got found in like a Miami hotel, like OD'd on meth because he was like having sex with like a gay prostitute, you know, so like, yeah, right. You know, he took the gubernatorial loss pretty hard, but, you know, yeah, I, you know, I'm excited about, you know, I don't know, the prospect of just saying, like, who cares?
Yeah.
Like, so what?
Yep.
Like, you know, and there's got to be an effective, scalable way to do that in a non-politically, like, extra political means. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm not talking about, like, running for state rep or something. I just mean, like, there's got to be, you know, like, I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet. I haven't found it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, pretty much every aspect of this is tied into politics, like every aspect.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, like, you know how, like, if you go to the store and why on earth would a middle-aged woman feel comfortable approaching a 25-year-old guy about, you're not wearing a mask, and if you don't put this mask on, I'm going to make sure that you get fired.
There's a restaurant in one of the buildings I work at, and one of the workers at the restaurant literally, like, got in a physical altercation with some guy because he walked in and didn't have a mask on. And she's like, put on your fucking mask. And he's like, oh, shit, I forgot at the car. I'll just be 1 second. She walked right up to him and started fighting him. Like, it's on security.
Right.
It's on surveillance video. It's crazy.
Right, so like, why would you ever feel comfortable? Like, why do we have a socio-political situation where people feel comfortable doing this type of stuff to people that face value could just kill them with their bare hands?
Yeah,
right. Like, is the Antichrist that strong that, you know, are things so far gone that this is where we're at. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, what's the counter to that? Like, you know,
I mean, you see it all across the globe. This is an opportunity. This whole pandemic has been an opportunity, and I'm like paraphrasing Michael Malice. This has been an opportunity for low status people to assert their dominance over other low status people. And
yeah, right. Of course. And because they love it, it gives them a sense of purpose, and it you know, they're a part of, you know, their teacher's pet. They're the good people. Mm-hmm. They think they're the ones that history will look back upon favorably.
Yep. And the,
you know, I mean, I
the counter proposal is something that has yet to be offered. You know, maybe a little bit. Like Ron DeSantis is a good example of the counter proposal, being "fuck you." If you get in my face, I will fucking rock you. And there's not, there's not going to be any consequences for my actions when I do that.
Yeah, because there needs to be some, like, because the problem right now, of course, is that if some old hag comes running up to you and starts giving you shit about, you know, you something is wrong with you. You need to wear your mask, or your truck is too loud, or, you know, whatever. Like, if you just say, like, look, lady, if you don't get away from me, I'm going to beat your ass, even though you're a woman twice my age, mm-hmm. you know, and you do it because whatever, you know, she shouldn't have, you know, been fucking with you, you know, like, there needs to be an avenue, like, some type of, you know, GoFundMe, you know, Patreon for, you know, for people that get fired over nonsense. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and obviously I'm not saying that, like, yeah, we need a way to, like, beat up old women. That's not my point here. The point is that why do these people feel comfortable going up and asking people to make very unreasonable changes to, like, their lifestyle and things like that over what they saw it on TV? There's no real, you know, no real evidence. These masks don't do anything. That's not really up for debate at this point. They're not rated to stop any particles. They're decorative. It's hey, I'm the hall monitor. You're not complying with what the guy that I voted for said.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start a video of you trying to buy a fucking bag of oranges at the grocery store. And if you don't get out your you know, hijab and cover your face, you know, I'm going to figure out where you live, and I'm going to figure out where you work. And BLM is going to go stand on your sidewalk, and you're not going to tell them to leave, or else you're a member of the Klan.
All those acts, you know, all those acts by the people perpetuating them are political acts. That's the thing, is that they know that.
Right, and that's what I mean when I say extra political. Like, they're political, but they're not in the representative pipeline. Like, yeah. I'm not talking about, like, you know what I mean? Like, these people aren't an elected official. These people have no state sanctioned authority other than the knowledge that nothing will happen to them.
Yeah, they're it's culturally sanctioned.
Right. So like, you know, there's got to be a way to turn the tide on that. But the problem is that, you know, I mean, most people, like I don't want to do that every time I go to the fucking store, right? No. Like, I don't want to have a discussion. I don't want to talk to anybody I don't know. I don't want to say hi to any. I literally just want to buy a fucking bag of oranges and leave. Like, I'm not, like, I don't have that energy that these people do, right? You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So, like, what's the method for that? How do you overcome that type
that's,
of thing?
That's the thing. You don't have the vigor, the radicalism. Well, not you particularly, but radicalism needs to be met with even more vigorous radicalism. So the second they walk up to you, you know in your head what they're going to say. Just fucking throw back and cock them.
Well, right, but then, you know, the problem is that it's like a negative versus positive rights situation, mm-hmm. though, too, where, you know, it's like, look, you don't have the right to just come talk to me. Like, I don't owe you my time.
Yep.
If you want to get in my way and start talking to me about this mask, like, you know, I'm just going to physically remove you from my path. Like, there's just,
it's going to take, you know, a lot of people legally martyring themselves in order to affect any type of conversation or change, in order to maybe make those people reconsider that act. It's going to take mass legal martyrdom. People are going to have to be arrested for punching an old lady in the face because that old lady approached them and got into their face and did all those examples you said. If they're met with, you know, even just a little bit of violence, like even just a push, like, yeah, they're still going to get arrested. But if that becomes the standard reaction, then culturally, it's going to temper the drive of those type of people to approach you.
Right. Right. I mean, it's turned everyone into cops. These people shouldn't feel safe. Like these people should not feel safe doing this stuff.
So when that happens, when people run over the protesters, when people punch the old ladies, and you see on your timeline that they got arrested or whatever, they need to be showered with praise, showered with positivity, contributed to their GoFundMe legal funds or whatever, to show that there's a cultural
component. That's why there has to be a market. Mm-hmm. That's why there's got to be a market for this. Like, there's no... Because, I mean, you can't have a GoFundMe, you know... You can only have a GoFundMe if it's to prove, you know, that number one, you have bad health insurance, or number two, that you love the Antichrist. Like, that's it. Those are the only two reasons. It's like, okay, it's either like a legitimately tragic story that is just shows the massive problems with the U.S. healthcare system, or it's something like, I just turned 18 and I'm trying to get, a penis installed on my forehead because I'm actually a fucking unicorn and, my boss doesn't agree. So he cut my shift.
Yeah. Like my child just turned 5 and decided he's decided she's a girl. So
right, I need bottom surgery for my toddler and, exactly. Like there were steps at the library when I was trying to go to drag queen story hour and I need a construction crew to smooth that out because it's a crime. You know, I'm disabled because I have really bad anxiety and I can't walk up steps.
Yeah. Like, there's a demand for that on the left. And there is a demand for the type of action that you're talking about, the type of response that you're talking about from the right. Like, I'm sure that, I mean, if I saw that on my, I do see it on my timeline, people resisting in their own way and running afoul of the legal system and getting canceled and all that, people will respond to that positively. People that are more in line with us, like more aligned with right-wing values, maybe not right-wing values, but anti-progressive values. They will respond positively to that. They will donate to your GoFundMe for a legal fund. They will shower you with praise. And it's kind of a white pill when you see it. It's just, you know, the algorithm makes sure that you don't see it that often.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's just a difficult, you know, problem to overcome because it's hidden by force. I mean, there are, you know, literally global networks of machines using artificial intelligence to make sure
to make a psychological profile of you, and
that a guy who swings a hammer for 8 hours a day can't go on Facebook and tell a funny joke because he's going to do black voice, right? Like, you know, I mean, these, like, we could be living like 60 planets further than fucking Mars if you were allowed to be funny. Like, if comedy was allowed, like, we would be just, you know, it wouldn't even be a problem because Marxists could just go live on another fucking planet. Like, yeah.
And until you hit about the 2,000 follower mark, your risk goes up exponentially of being unpersoned for any type of comedy that might run afoul.
Yeah. I wonder if there's like a, you know how everyone's saying that Bitcoin is evil because it's bad for the environment? Mm-hmm. Like, I wonder if there's a way to say that, like, you know, tech AI censorship just uses way too much electricity, and it's actually, it's discreetly a form of white supremacy and, entitlement because we could power 10 black neighborhoods with the effort that we use to have Twitter bots stop people from saying the N-word on the timeline.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, I mean, that's a hard sell to most progressives because they're willing to fucking burn the entire state of California in order to get one person off Twitter who said the N-word once.
Yeah, right. It's right. Just trying to you're getting kicked out of, like, you know, a city council meeting because you're trying to convince them that, you know, it's actually more economical to let you say the N-word.
Jesus. I'll leave you with this quote, and you can chew on this. If we are to avoid the eventual the eventual catastrophe of world conflict, we must strengthen the United Nations. As the first step towards world government, we Americans will have to yield up some of our sovereignty. That would be a bitter pill. It would take a lot of courage, a lot of faith in the new order. That's one Mr. Walter Cronkite who said that.
Yeah. Yeah, well.
The only response I can think of is, I do very much hate the Antichrist.
As do I.
Yep, so fuck you, Walter Cronkite. Faggot. So it all goes back to globalism.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't believe me, it does,
yeah,
all right?
The end. Point blank, yeah. All right. It doesn't actually hurt your feelings that I gave you a swirly. It's just globalist mind control making you think that I hurt your feelings.
All right, man. I think that about wraps it up. Do you have any plugs before I pull the plug?
Yeah, in InBlockPress, Substack. Go subscribe. It's inblockpress.substack.com. Weekly newsletter, the occasional political rantings, mostly focused on 3D printing, guns, and right-wing politics.
I like it. And where can they find you on Twitter?
@in_block_press.
Excellent. All right, man. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.